Welcome to Michigan HockeyCast 4.1, where we will discuss first-round pick after first-round pick after first-round pick after first-round pick. We could be here for a while. We need to start with the most important question. There's probably a lot of questions, but the most important one is, have you found a suitable replacement for Culver's up in Canada?
Not really. Not yet. I've sampled a few burger places, but
like good burger places are like, I mean, Culver's isn't a bad burger, but I mean, it's not like if you're looking for the best burger, you're not like, oh, you got to go to Culver's. Like, there are good burgers places. So are you going for like everyday burgers? Call them everyday burgers. Is this the type of places you're looking
for? Yeah, just generic burgers and shakes type places, you know?
Yeah.
Comparable, I guess, to like the Elevation Burgers of the world, RIP.
Where they actually have the cow in the backyard.
Yeah, Bagger Dave's, RIP.
Bagger Dave's.
Yeah, that's a deep dive for some people. But no, I mean, I'm not eating out that much. So
what about your other places? Like you always ate at Panda?
Panda's hard to find. There is one, but it's not very close. And the other thing about Toronto is there's a ton of like really good Asian food.
There's no reason to go to Panda. Yeah. I guess we should, since this is the opening podcast, my name is David Nasternak and you're Pat McAfee. I mean, Alexander Drain. I mean, seriously, you have like this little tank top on and like, did you see him on the Manning cast a couple weeks ago? He's just like sitting there all ripped with his arms out like this old punter. And you're just like, oh, all right, he's just hanging out in his tank top. And I was like, oh, Pat McAfee is on with me today. But
yeah,
you're Alex Drain. We've done this for a year. This is, I guess, season four.
If you don't know who we are,
but where have you been? I guess you're here now because Michigan hockey is supposed to be awesome. So it makes sense for you to be here now. But
yeah, anyway. I've mostly been doing football stuff, but now transitioning to the sport that more people care about, at least that listen to this podcast.
Listen. I'm glad you think people listen to this podcast. That's the confidence we need to keep this going. So, but Alex is moo, as we talked about at the end of last season. I feel like this is a TV show. We have like our own TV show.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Alex moved to Canada to go to grad school. So he's in Toronto, where apparently there are no Culver's, which has made him sad. And Panda Express has become irrelevant.
Yes, but there are Chipotles around.
There's
one about 15 minutes walkable. I've gone there a number of times.
Is it as bad as the one that we went to on
Stadium? The one in Stadium in Ann Arbor is...
that was the worst.
It's unique. So, there was a game this weekend.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So, we can get right into that. There was an exhibition game. Before we talk about the preview of the team, Michigan hockey plays an exhibition game against Bowling Green, who was good last year.
Yeah. Bailey Johnson, friend of the pod, decided to tweet out about Bowling Green before doing any research, which is the correct thing to do. Well done, Bailey. Always tweet before you look it up.
Don't waste your time looking up Bowling Green hockey.
And
there
so
are better things.
She pointed out that Bowling Green was very good last year. If you do look it up, they lost pretty much everyone, which the Gopher State guy, I guess, not a friend of the podcast,
Nate Wells is great. You can't be slamming Nate Wells.
I don't think he's appeared on this podcast and you have
he is not. He's asked about it before and we've talked about it. And so it got really difficult in the middle season when there was not a real other co-host and I was trying to find another one and I probably should have come to you, but my phone wouldn't connect to the chargers or the connection pieces that we had to the recording equipment. So I couldn't call anybody in. So everything had to be in person and he lived in Minneapolis and now I think in New York City. So that's a long way from where I am.
Yeah.
So well, he never made it on, but Gopher State, Nate Wells.
Yeah. He replied to the Bailey tweet and pointed out that Bowling Green has lost all of their players, which I looked up. They did lose, I think, like their top five scorers.
That's a lot.
Yeah. So I don't think this is a very good Bowling Green team. They're probably in the 40 to 45 pairwise range, you know, before you really get into the Atlantic Hockey teams. But they're not very good. But, you know, Michigan, when they were really playing their starters, was just kind of running them out of the gym. And Bowling Green was playing all of their starters that they have. So, you know,
yeah,
we can take something from that.
And I think Kent Johnson scores like, what, a minute into this game?
Yeah, and you could tell it was an exhibition game because he's like a million miles away from the play, not even bothering to back check. Like
Pavel Bure just sitting at the blue line.
Waiting to go for the breakaway. So definitely not high intensity, but they showed some things that were interesting. And obviously we got to learn that Maki Samoskovich did not play, but is probably going to play this weekend.
Yeah.
Sure has an injury of some length, probably in the 4 week range. That's useful. Also some power play stuff we'll talk about later. So,
yeah, I'm not really sure what else there is to take away. I mean, Michigan seemed to dominate for the most part. Again, part of it is the Bowling Green competition. Part of it is, well, that's sort of what we expect from Michigan this year. But they get, I think, 7 goals. I think Brisson had 3 and Nick Blankenberg had 2, including a nice snipe from straight away on the power play. And Ciccolini added 1 in too. So they got up to 7, gave up a goal late on sort of a fluffy little turnover in front of the net. And
once Portillo was out of the game.
Yeah, was he? I was going to say, I don't even think he gave that goal up. I think that was Levy.
No, yeah.
So, yeah, it was fun and it was entertaining to have on in the background. But are we going to draw a lot of conclusions from that? Probably not.
It's
given the context.
It is more useful than preseason in any of the professional sports.
Where you think so?
Yes, because you actually got to learn some stuff about the lines, and you actually got to see some of the players play. Like, you know, that they still had to play some guys. Like the professionals, they don't even bother to play guys, and like the margin doesn't matter. And
sure.
So.
Well, all right. So that's out of the way. You can go look up more statistics on it if you want, but we are going to jump right into the team preview. So we'll start with the forwards because, holy crap, there's a lot of them, and wow, are they good.
Yeah. The story of the offseason for people who are just sauntering in and haven't really been keeping up with things.
Where have you been?
They return all of the forward production. Except for like one Jack Becker goal and
a couple saver against Arizona State,
a couple Dakota Raby assists, but everybody is back and you add a few more pieces and now things get very interesting.
So we talked a little bit about this on the Friday MGO radio show on the fourth segment. It was very live and fun segment. Go check that out. But I said at the beginning, and we've talked about this in the past and probably even last year, but it's not as much about lines, I think, this year for Michigan as it is about pairs and then finding the right person to put on that pair to make it a line. As we talked, you know, KJ and Beniers played together last year. Brisson and Bortolo played together last year. Probably Moyle and Van Wy going to be anchoring line 4. Line 3 is a question mark, but I don't even think that there's like a line 1 and 2. I think it's basically line 1 and line 1A, and one of them's going to be out there and then the other one's going to be out there, and they're each going to hopefully have the guy that fits nicely with them. But I mean, if you had to pick between Bortolo and Brisson and then KJ and Beniers, the answer is yes.
Yeah. It gives you really what a lot of NHL teams try to do, which is you have two lines that you can go to and can feel good about in terms of tilting the ice. And, you know, you just look at teams across the NHL, and you generally have that effective second line, right? One of the great secrets of Boston's success for 10 plus years was that they also had David Krejci, one of the great underrated players of his generation, on top of Bergeron and, you know, Marchand now. And in the past, you had other wingers on that line. And obviously Tampa has one line that has Braden Point and another line that also has Steven Stamkos. Like, that's what you try to do. That's what you try to build in terms of lines. So Michigan should have two lines that they trust, that, that they feel can really tilt the ice in their favor, and you know, fitting the pieces together. But they are a little bit different in terms of what you offer on those two lines.
So KJ and Beniers, we'll start there. We both listed them sort of as our one, even though, you know, whatever, one and 1A. I mean, Kent Johnson scores a goal 2 minutes into the game, has, like Brian mentioned, I believe on radio, he said, you know, point per game production thereabouts. He seemed to get a lot of secondary assists last year, so it seemed like his stats were a bit inflated. But if you look at his junior numbers, they were bonkers, and he was young coming in, true freshman. This is sort of a potential breakout year for him. I mean, you could almost say that about half this team, but he's probably the guy that headlines. If you're going to see a guy really take off and come into his own, he's near the top of the list.
Yeah, I think with Johnson especially, you look at him in particular, you had three guys that came in last year who were underage. So you had Power, Beniers, and Kent Johnson. And Power has the size advantage, particularly the height. Beniers is a little bit more filled out, a little thicker. And then Johnson was a very wiry frame, had room to grow physically. Mm-hmm. And it also seemed that he had room to grow in terms of adjusting to the pace of the NCAA at times, sort of making decisions on the fly, and certainly decision-making in terms of opting for more difficult plays when easier plays that were just as effective were available. Those are things that you want to see him clean up. And he did collect a high degree of secondary assists. We have the numbers on that. Secondary assists, empirically, from people who studied it over the years, are highly random and highly variable, really predictive of primary assists or points in general, with goals factored in. So, you know, he could end up scoring also a point per game, but end up being a materially better player.
Right.
Because if he gets a little less secondary assist luck, what you want to see him do more is get to the high danger areas. And you often hear the perimeter player name, you know, tossed around with different guys. And it's a highly debated topic in the scouting community. Is there such thing as a perimeter player? Johnson's definitely one of those guys that had that thrown around, right? He tended to play more to the outside. He would kind of dance around the perimeter, look to make his move or to find his passing lane. And he wasn't big on puck retrievals. He wasn't really fighting around the net. And I do think a part of that is the physical component, right? It takes strength to get to the inner portion between the dots and around the crease. And that's what you want to see. You want to see him having added some strength, feeling a little more confident and more assertive, instead of gliding around the exterior, really trying to drive inside and make things happen aggressively.
The two things that kind of come to mind with him, we mentioned sort of the secondary assist thing, but the two other things are, one, he sort of had a knack for the spectacular. Like, a lot of his goals were very backhander facing away from the net. He had one, I think, against Minnesota where he gets down into the crease and just sort of roofs this backhand that goes like high over the glove. And you're like, whoa, like these high end stuff. And there's nothing wrong with that. But part of it is just sort of getting your sort of like normal goals where, like you were talking about, drive the net, create a high danger opportunity, maybe dish the puck off. The other thing was a little bit of sort of a fancy Dan passer at times, where instead of making just the fundamental pass or turn and hit a guy in the tape, he's sort of pivoting and go back spinning and then having a drop pass or something that's a little loose at times. And like you were saying, the speed of the game kind of caught up to him a couple of times, and we'd get a turnover or just had an easy play to a teammate and sort of turned it into a more difficult opportunity.
Yeah, and I think it was kind of frustrating at times because the high skill sometimes just sort of seemed like a gadget thing, as sort of oh, that's neat. You know, like he pulled a move and you're like, yeah, that was pretty cool. But it wasn't really leading to anything, right?
And it's like a highlight tape.
Yeah. And so as I wrote over the summer, one of the things that scouts really look for is the ability to blend skills. And integrate different skills on top of each other and lead to more productive outcomes. And so, you know, the fear is that it was sort of a one-trick pony, especially when you think about the NHL level, and right, that he's going to be like a Nikita Gusev, right? Like, okay, he can stick handle, but like it doesn't get him anywhere. Like he's still too slow in Gusev's case, right? And with Johnson, he's not big enough. And so can he actually do that skill, do those stick handling moves, do the, you know, flash that raw talent while it actually leads to something productive and not just like, oh, that's neat. And that's going to be the question, right? Like he has the skill and he's produced, and now it's sort of linking those two together, more of the kinds of plays that we saw when he had that goal against Minnesota, where he comes flying down the wing, draws it, you know, backhand to forehand, and then puts it bar down. Like that's the sort of thing you want to see, seeing him playing faster and playing more assertive with the puck.
Well, I think that a number of people think he can do that because he was taken fifth overall.
Jarmo Kekäläinen certainly does.
we did have not mentioned that he was taken, and you said he was underage, so his draft year was last July, and he went a fifth overall to the Blue Jackets, I believe.
Blue Jackets, yep.
So his pair buddy is pairing, I guess, in and forward is Matty Beniers. And this is a guy Michigan gets last year because Harvard decides they aren't going to play hockey, or maybe all of sports, actually.
All of sports, yep.
So he's kind of SOL and is like, oh, I want to play some hockey. And Michigan's like, hey, why don't you come play for us? And he plays and ends up getting drafted number two.
Yep.
Overall. So Michigan, right?
First ever draft pick in Seattle Kraken history.
Yes. And there was some talk about maybe he would leave, maybe he wouldn't come back. He was pretty good last year. He wasn't like can't miss Jack Eichel good, I don't think. But he did a lot of things really, really well. And there's an argument that he was probably the best player on Michigan's team last year.
Yeah, he could have left and played in the league. The concern would be two words, Jesperi Kotkaniemi, who the Montreal Canadiens drafted very high in the draft. They forced him into the NHL at age 18. He was able to play. He was able to hack it, but it stunted his development, and there's no question about that. And the Kraken made the smart move. They did not rush Beniers into the NHL, and they're going to let him take some time and simmer and build skills and not have to be competing against, you know, very large and very muscular men on a nightly basis, like you would do in the NHL. So I think coming back to the NCAA is a really good decision for him. And he's the guy that, because he definitely could have left, I don't really have a lot that I'm looking for in terms of this is one thing he needs to improve on. If it would be anything, maybe shoot a little more. I don't know. I mean, he's a guy with a very polished game.
Yeah, 10 goals. I mean, he led the team in goals, and they only played 24 games. So, I mean, that's a pretty nice ratio.
I mean, he's an extremely polished player, especially for that age, and is going to be playing a lot, probably on power play number one, potentially on penalty kill number one. Depends on how they devise that. We'll talk about it later. But he's going to be playing in all situations. And again, I just don't really think there's that much he can improve on.
He's kind of what we want to see Kent Johnson be in that regard, where Johnson has that one or two really good skills, and Matty Beniers is sort of the opposite of that, where he doesn't have this elite skill. He has a lot of really good skills.
Yeah, and with Johnson, you're sort of like, well, as a prospect, there's a chance he's, you know, again, a Nikita Gusev type where he doesn't really hack it and he's not really an NHL player. There's also the chance he's Mitch Marner, right? Like there's a chance he's a very good player and there's a chance that he doesn't hack it. Beniers is going to play in the NHL for a long time, but his ceiling is probably lower. So that's the trade-off.
And he probably wasn't the second best player in the draft, but he was probably the safest player.
He's the second best player in the draft right now, probably. But you are drafting on who's going to be the best NHL player in 2028.
So now we can kind of debate where we want to go with this. So if you have KJ and Beers, let's say on the first line, who do you think goes on that line? You mentioned Dylan Duke, who is a freshman, played on the USNTDP, the under 18 team last year, had a nice year. I think that that he probably does fit there because they can play him in front of the net?
It's definitely an option. What we saw from the preseason game, just looking at the lines they rolled out there, was that they had Beniers and Johnson with Philip Lapointe, but it was said after the game by Mel Pearson that Samoskevich had been skating on that line, and that Lapointe was filling in more or less. Whereas Duke was on a line with Bortolo and Bersan in the preseason lines. So that's a hint into how they're skating in practice. I would be fine with Duke there because I do think that they could play him around the net. However, before we really talk about the power play, but just as a nugget, and what we saw is that we saw Beniers playing the net front on the power play. And so that's a hint, perhaps, that one of the things that Mel's staff has told Beniers to work on is to play more around the net. And so if he's playing more around the net, then the need to have Duke there is a little bit lower. And then perhaps you could roll out a more high skill guy like Samoskevich.
So should we talk about Mackey then in this
sure.
spot? So the only thing that I would say that I wouldn't like about that, and obviously I know nothing compared to the people that are deciding these lines, or do I? Is the fact that, like, when we talk about Mackey, you think that he has more like a highly creative and a like a play generator, and Beniers and KJ are kind of that already. So is that a little bit of a lot of one thing?
If you put him on that line, you are counting on that line to just sort of be offensive, you know, overload more or less. Mm-hmm. Like, that line's going to go crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Mackey's whole scouting profile for the draft was really focused around the offensive toolkit, the ability to shoot, to pass, to create. And so if you put him there, you know, him and Johnson playing together, and then I guess probably having Beniers in the high danger areas, that's a line that's going to create a lot of offense. And I think if you do that, then you're hoping that Beniers patches things up defensively. That's what I would say, which obviously he's capable of doing that, but Samoskevich is going to be a first year player, not really marketed as much of a defensive player. And Johnson doesn't really have, you know, a lot of defense in sort of his wheelhouse. So that would be your concern. Your concern would be that it is the Winnipeg Jets top line, where just like nobody plays defense, nobody back
now, but we're going to score a bunch of goals.
But thankfully you'll have Beniers out there, and he at least will do something to prevent that.
So anything that you really want to get into with Samoskevich? It's Samoskevich, Samoskevich. I'm probably going to be calling him Samo throughout the year because tweeting that out over and over and over again is not going to happen. We're going to find some nickname, sort of like we talked about Kent Johnson as KJ, because it's so much easier to like make notes on and deliver information.
Or just Mackey, I guess.
Could do Mackey too.
Yeah, I mean, he's a really, really highly talented prospect. Went pretty much where most people thought he would go, I believe 23rd of the first round. So, you know, higher than Bersan went last year. And we kind of used Brisson's stat line to give us a hint at what we could see with Mackey. But if he gets to play with those guys, he's going to score a lot.
Yeah, or at least have some – or put points on the board in one way or another. Sure. So line two, or 1A, or one, for all we know, it will be centered by the guy who had the most points for Michigan last year, Thomas Bortolo. Probably had some of the sweetest goals of the year, including that overtime winner in Madison, which hopefully is gift somewhere. He was an early second-round pick last year by the Sharks, I believe.
By the Sharks.
And he's a smaller guy. More on the creative type, I think, in terms of he will score some goals, but he fits well with Brendan Bersan, who's on his wing, as Bersan is definitely a shooter and Bortolo is sort of the Steve Nash creator, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I love Thomas Bortolo. I think that the Sharks got incredible value for him where they picked him. I mean, he was one of the biggest risers in the D+1 year among that draft class. And, you know, the way he played last year, honestly, is a lot of the way you would want to see Kent Johnson play this year, as more of a guy who's more assertive And I mean, Bortolo was Michigan's truly their best creator, their best passer. You know, he can do a whole lot. But the other thing was that he wins a lot of faceoffs, and he was very comfortable in the defensive zone, which is not something that was on his draft scouting card.
No, and we were worried about that in the preseason last year.
And people who had watched the USHL were quite sort of like, I don't know how to hold up in the defensive end. And he managed to be fine in that end of the ice. And, you know, obviously his ability to win faceoffs means he's going to get a lot of DZ starts to begin with. And, you know, he scored a ton of points last year. He was Michigan's highest scorer. And he very easily is a, you know, a clear Hobie Baker candidate entering this year.
And his wingman, I guess we'll call him in that pairing, is Brendan Brisson. He was a late first round pick by the Vegas Golden Knights, I believe. Yep. Also had 10 goals, 11 assists in 24 games, which is slightly under a point per game. Is basically known for his bombs from the right point or the right dot, I guess. I mean, he scored several goals. I think he even had at least one from there on Saturday against Bowling Green. I thought the interesting thing about him was throughout the year, you could see him start to develop as a passer a little bit more. And he started to set up guys and see them cutting to the net and hitting them, got a couple assists that way. And that's something that I think if he makes that leap this year and starts to also feed pucks, I mean, he's going to kind of jump really high up in terms of potentially leaving at the end of the year.
Yeah, I mean, he was extremely improved by the end of the season, really got that chemistry going with Bortolo, which you wanted to see. And this year, he should be one of Michigan's top scorers. He's going to be, again, hinting at the power play, but he's going to be one of their featured options there. He was a featured option there last year, but I know they're going to try to set that up pretty heavily. And you know, playing with Bortolo and whoever else they put on this line, he's going to get a lot of opportunities to score. And I think there's a chance he can make a really big leap too. And he, you know, is a hell of a shooter. And Michigan is, there's not a lot of guys like him that can shoot at that level at the NCAA level, and Michigan needs to utilize it. And Bortolo is able to play to his skill set, and Bortolo creates a lot of opportunities for Brisson.
The one thing that negative thing that we should mention about him that did fade by the end of the year is he took a lot of kind of goofy penalties, like 2-minute penalties early on in the season, just like offensive or neutral zone penalties that you're kind of like, you know, okay, I don't mind the aggressiveness a little bit, but hey man, let's try to stay 5-on-5 because we got more talent. But that did fade. I mean, I think we had up to like 5 or 6 in the first half of the season, and he only ended up, it looks like, with 9 penalties. So
yeah,
hopefully he'll continue that trend and we'll clean that up.
Yeah.
The guy that we put on the second line or this line, and maybe he won't be there, I thought he fit really well towards the end of the year, and I thought this line really started to jump as maybe the best line that Michigan had, is Eric Cicalline. He's going to be in his third year, I believe. I mean, I guess second, depending on what the COVID year and all that stuff. But he started to kind of find his role as a bit of a shooter on this line, which works really well with Bortolo. And when you have a shooter on the opposite side, Cicalline ended up with 7 goals and 5 assists in 24 games. So only half a point per game, which is low, but I think he started to really find his niche as the year went along.
Well, his role, you know, bounced around, and he was on a bunch of different lines. His scoring line was very similar to his freshman year, which is a little disappointing because you thought he could make more of a step forward. I mean, for Cicalline, it really just comes down to where is he playing, right? Like,
yeah,
if Duke is on this line and he's back on the third line, he'll probably just be in that half point per game range again. If he's playing up in the lineup, maybe he could score a little more. And, you know, he's another guy who can play around the net a little bit. So whether it's him or Duke on this line, I think those are both logical fits for this unit.
So we touched a little bit on Dylan Duke. Actually, so those are kind of the first two lines, and those are a lot of the options who we think that will be there. The third line is where it gets kind of interesting, especially with the news that Johnny Beecher's out. We can touch on him quickly. He's a first-round pick from, it seems like, 7 years ago, but it's really only 3 years ago. I don't think anyone really expected him to be here for 3 years, but he did get hurt He did get hurt last year, and he's hurt again to start this year. He was also drafted.
He was also hurt his freshman year too. At the end of the season, he was playing with a broken wrist or thumb. Yeah. I don't remember what it was.
So that's probably stunted his growth a little bit. The other thing was he was probably drafted a little bit higher than a number of people would have guessed, and so wearing that first round tag, because I believe it was like 30th overall, maybe.
Yes, 30th overall to Boston. When you say it's surprising he's been here 3 years, it really surprising to who you talk to, right? Because
some people would be like, I might be there longer.
He was in the 25 range on Pronman's board before the draft, but there were other people that had him in the 70 or 80 range. He was a guy that a lot of scouts had different opinions on. I think he's looked more like the people who were bearish on him, and sort of the concern was that he's just kind of a big guy and scouts get magnetized to that. And his skill set is enticing. He can move pretty well for that size. He has the size, he has a decent shot. He can play some in the defensive zone. It's just, there doesn't seem to be that just high end ability to sort of break a game open, drive a line at the NCAA level. And when you look at him as certainly as an NHL prospect, he starts to look more and more like a third or a fourth line center at that level.
He did finally score on a breakaway last year, though.
Yeah, he gets a decent number of those.
Which took him a little bit, and we were kind of like, Beecher, you better put this one away. But I think he actually kind of fits perfectly as a third line center on this team when you look at it, because I think like there was some talk about, do you stack him on the wing with one of those top two lines? But putting him on the third line, there's going to be a guy left over, whether it's Duke Cicalline or Mackie Samuskevich. And one of those guys is going to get to play with him. They're probably going to get to play one of the next few guys we're going to talk about who are going to be older, more experienced players. And that line probably isn't – the third line probably isn't going to be the high-end scoring line that the first two are, but it's probably going to be a pretty disciplined line. It's going to be experienced, and you're going to at least have some trustworthy guys on the ice for those particular shifts.
Yeah, I mean, I think that third line should be fine. I think that their ice time isn't going to be super high, but when they get out there, they should be fine.
Yeah. The guy that we put on that line, and you know, who knows, this could end up wherever, but was Mike Pastyov. We call him Pasta, as so does the hockey group, I guess, when they tweet out. It's always the like spaghetti with meatballs emoji, but
yes,
which makes a lot of sense. His brother was here. Now he's here for, I guess this is his fifth year too. And he's kind of an interesting guy too, who blew up at the beginning of the year, carried some scoring for Michigan early, but sort of fell off as the year went along. I think they moved him off of the line of the Brisson-Bordeleau line, probably impacted his scoring. He just kind of does things fine. I don't think there's any real negatives when he's on the ice. He makes some plays. He's learned to pass more, I think, as his career went along. He put 7 pucks in the net last year in 24 games, which, again, also isn't too bad. But he's just kind of a guy, but a guy that you can trust in in these sorts of situations.
Yeah, I mean, he's a decent scorer. Can shoot a little bit. He's veteran. He's been around. He's also now the last man standing from the Frozen Four team. Luke Morgan was also on the team, but wasn't playing. That was his transfer sit out year. But so, you know, I think that experience is valuable. And I think his ability to score combined with the age thing is why he's back. That would be my guess. And if he gets in, he should be fine.
So then we can transition to guys that probably are more fourth line-ish. This is the pairing that we kind of liked, was Van Wy, because he's played center here for the last 3 years, centering that third or fourth line. His wingman, Nolan Moyle, pretty much been in the same spot too. They're not like the same guys specifically, but they fit well together, and they each kind of have their spot. And Moyle had 4 goals, 3 assists in 25 games last year. Van Wy had 3 goals and 2 assists, but they're that like sort of grind line, gritty, get in the corners, retrieve pucks. They win faceoffs. They create a lot of havoc. Not the most high-end talent where you're going to see guys picking corners, but they've created a number of goals in their careers just simply by outworking their opponents.
Yeah, I mean, they're hardworking guys. They hustle, and they are, you know, they make the team harder to play against.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's such a cliched line because it gets brought up all the time in hockey circles. And what you always want to do is have guys that do make the team harder to play against. There's something to be said for physicality, but you never want that to be at the expense of, you know, actually players who are good. And that's
skill.
That's kind of just the trade-off, is that a lot of times teams, especially in the NHL, will go out and, you know, they'll get Wayne Simmonds or, you know, guys like a Luke Witkowski for the Red Wings, just like these guys who at this point are AHL players, and they get thrown out there because, like, well, we need someone to hit and fight. And what's nice about Van Wyn and Moyle is that they do make the team harder to play against. And when they play, I don't really feel like there's someone better that's sitting. And that's the big thing. And that's what you want in that role, that they give the team something and they don't take away anything. And especially on this team where they won't be asked to do anything offensively. I mean, I would guess that their percent of the time they start in the defensive zone is going to be 70 or 80%. And, you know, they'll play on the penalty kill and that'll be about it. And you won't need them to be in the offensive zone very much, which is a big contrast to several years ago
when they were freshmen,
arguably Michigan's best offensive line.
Well, and like you mentioned them playing on the penalty kill, and like Michigan struggled on the penalty kill in the first half of the season. And part of that unit getting better was these two players really picking up their game when they were on the man disadvantage. And like, I just noticed Van Wy specifically deflecting tons of passes, always had a stick in the lane, and Moyle was always playing with him. And they're just kind of those high effort guys that if they really, you know, glom onto that, to those roles, I mean, that's the type of thing that could make this team really, really good.
Yeah. I mean, they have a role to play, as I referenced in my season previews, that I talked about. You know, you look at the late 90s through late 2000s Red Wing teams, like you have Stanley, you know, Hall of Famers up and down the lineup, but you still had Chris Draper and Kirk Malby out there. Like, there's still a role to play for that kind of player, even on this sort of a team. And I mean, God, look at Tampa, you know, with their line of Gaudreau, Coleman, and Yanni Gord. I mean, that was their third or fourth line, and that was a hugely important line to what they were able to do and how they got over the hump. So there are roles to play for guys who can hit and who can make your team just tougher to play against.
Two of the guys that will probably rotate or get their shots to play on this line are Nick Granowitz and Luke Morgan, two sort of opposite end of the spectrum guys. Luke Morgan is a speedster who works really, really hard. He's a coach favorite. Mel has tried to get him going in as many ways as possible. He's created a ton of breakaways. Also, not always the best at finishing them, but his speed gets him out in front of players, and he does go hard to the net, does do everything you want. He's just, well, he's still in college for the sixth or seventh year for a reason.
Well, Luke Morgan, he might get a shot at the third center position until Beecher's healthy.
It'll
be either him or Jimmy Lambert until then, you would think. And I like Morgan more than Lambert because of that speed aspect. Like, he does have one skill that you can define and can test the opponent. And I think he could play on this line simply because Dakota Raby's thing was speed too.
Right. Exactly.
Morgan's faster than Raby. So in terms of as a replacement, he's a decent option. I mean, it for him, it all just comes down to the fact that he cannot shoot to save his life. I mean, you look at his shooting percentages across college, and it's just like, kind of, this is who he is. Like, you know, guys can improve as a shooter sometimes. Michigan ex-Wolverine Zach Hyman is one of the few guys who got like a lot better at shooting in the NHL, but it's pretty rare that happens. And there's so much data at this point that this is just sort of who Luke Morgan is, and you just kind of have to live with it.
the other guy that we talked about originally for this spot, Nick Granowitz, also could see some time on the third line. It, you know, the Beecher injury does complicate things in terms of they're probably going to be moving guys in and out of roles. We're kind of talking about it more as when Beecher's back and all of a sudden this is sort of the full all-go team that you're going to hopefully see and expect throughout the year. But Nick Granowitz was, I believe he started as a walk-on a couple of years ago, was sort of your big-bodied winger who you'd put in front of the net, the trash man who'd, like, get pucks deflected. And he, I think, took a few strides in terms of skill last year where he drew a couple penalties just by outskating a few players. They put him with a couple guys that could move and skate, and he ended up in some good spots and created some chances. He's not probably a top six guy like we've talked about a lot of the players on this team, but he's another one of those – other skaters that can contribute in these ways, maybe kill some penalties and just kind of be a nuisance around the net and in the corners.
Yeah, I'm a Nick Granowitz fan. I'd like to see him
in you and Craig Ross
in a pretty regular capacity on either the third or fourth line. He works hard. He bangs around the net. He just has a tendency to get some goals. You know, he's scored whatever five. How many did he have last year? Because he had, I think, seven hit the year before.
He had five goals and six assists. So he almost had a half a point a game.
You know, he can chip in six or eight goals over a full season, maybe 10 if his shooting percentage goes out of whack. But yeah, he's a useful player, and I think he has a more defined skill set than some of the other players that we are discussing.
The other guys, there's a few left in the forward category. Philippe Lapointe, who is Martin Lapointe's kid, I'm sure that is the new Spike Albrecht story. Jimmy Lambert's been around for a few years now. And then Mark Estapa, I believe, who got some skating time on Saturday as well. All three of those guys will get their shots, obviously, with Beecher out in the third line sort of
I think there's
air.
I think there's a chance Lapointe becomes a regular guy just because he was the dude they dropped onto the top line when, you know, Mackie Samoskevich gets hurt. So
he got a little bit of power play time last year, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, they like him a lot. So I think the chances of him are pretty decent. Again, Lambert will be with Luke Morgan as the, you know, number three center until Beecher's healthy. And even when he's healthy, they're probably one of those two is the 13th skater, just because I think Mel will want a fifth center in the lineup if someone gets hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And then Estapa, you know, he's already won a great achievement, which is that he managed to survive getting processed more or less.
That on a team that's absolutely stacked with players.
There is this long list of players once upon a time, and that's why if you've followed Michigan hockey recruiting long enough, you remember some names at programs like Ohio State, for example, that you're like, oh, that guy was a Michigan commit once upon a time. I'm trying to think of the guy last year that's on their team now. But they got another one in Cole McWard, these names that you used to hear, and then they eventually got – oh, Patrick Guzzo, that's his name. But
oh yeah,
Mark Estapa was in that group of guys that just slowly got purged, and then he survived. Everyone else on the list, you know, got sort of told, well, there isn't really room for you, so you should probably look somewhere else. But they took Estapa, and that probably says something.
Yeah, and being on this team is a team that you're, in theory, hopefully going to want to be on, even if you don't do a whole lot, because there is a lot of potential to do a lot of different things and go a long way. Do we have time to get into the defense, or should
we take a break?
No, we
will
take
a break and come back and
talk
about the defense.
So stick around.
If you find yourself in the penalty box in Ann Arbor or Metro Detroit, you want a Michigan man arguing your case. Call former prosecutor and now criminal defense attorney Jonathan Paul, the Michigan Law Grad, at 248-924-9458, or visit his website at michiganlawgrad.com.
Talk about defense, a lot of times you talk about defense, but the funny thing is that if we talk about defense, we might actually start talking about offense again, because when you look at some of the guys that are on Michigan's defensive core, they are going to score a lot of goals or assist a lot of goals and be heavily involved in some of the offense. And I think that starts with the number one overall pick, who we're not totally surprised is back for a second year, just given how old he was last year and some of his, I don't even want to say struggles, but learning curve, I guess would be the right term there, is Owen Power, who is the number one overall pick, like I said, to the Buffalo Sabres. And is he going to be the best defenseman in college hockey?
Maybe. I mean, it's not surprising.
Decisive.
It's not surprising he's back simply because also Buffalo picked him, and they are in the tank for Shane Wright mode. They are, you know, engaged in a hostage situation regarding Jack Eichel. And so... You know, there wasn't a lot
rushing
of
him was almost no point.
Yeah. So Owen Power is back, and there's going to be a lot of good defensemen out there. I mean, there's certainly going to be about four of them on Minnesota. So I don't really know. I don't watch all 60 teams, so I can't really tell you.
You should watch more Atlantic hockey because they might send three teams to the tournament.
but you know, Power, he also, unlike Beniers, I think, had things to improve on coming back. So
yes.
You want to see him, at least I do, I want to see him be more violent and really using that size, because hockey men love, you know, big defensemen. We all know this, but the size is only useful if you know how to use it, right? Like, you could be 6'5", but if you're not actually doing anything with it, it's just, you're just taking up more space. Like, that's all it's really doing. Whereas you think about sort of big physically imposing defensemen and the way they can use that ability to their advantage, right?
Yes.
Whether it's obviously sort of big defensemen of yesteryear, guys like Rob Blake or Chris Pronger, like, nobody was posting up in front of the net when Pronger on the ice.
They were,
like,
posting up on their knees.
Like, they just got rid of them, right? Like, and Chris Chelios wasn't big, but that's another guy that I would tell Owen Power to, like, watch, right? Like, I mean, Chris Chelios was a mean player and a vicious player, and Power can't do that stuff at the NCAA level, but just sort of that aggressive mindset, making sure that when you go into the corner, you're coming away with the puck, right? Yep. Nobody is beating you to those physical battles. No one is getting in front of the net. Like, he should be able to just clear out space a lot easier. And last year, I think he was just too gentle and in sort of the way he plays. That's one thing. And secondly, you want to see more offensive skill if it's there, right? We saw some flashes. He had a really nice highlight reel goal against Wisconsin. We've seen some passes on the power play. But, you know, you're not going to ask him to be Quinn Hughes, but you want to see him do a little bit more, because the fear with him as an NHL player is that he's just kind of becomes like a big body, like a Noah Hanifin, right? Just like, okay, he's fine, but he isn't really doing anything. And if it's in there, this is the time to show it.
He also had that one time a game where he would phase out of existence and just sort of fall over his own stick and turn the puck over, which made absolutely zero sense. And building on what you said before, I found interesting is, like, you know, you could always see how tall and big he was because he had that long stick that he would use his speed to be able to break up a play. And that's really awesome that you can do that. And then when you add the element that you were just talking about of moving guys out of the way and not letting anyone pass and just exerting the fact that you have more mass and density than most of the people that around you, just would allow him to just do things that probably no one else on this team is really capable of.
Yeah, I would definitely agree.
And his partner is a really interesting player. This is, you know, it's kind of like we talk about some of those, like, glory years of Michigan defense under Harbaugh from, like, 16 to 18. And that was like the Winovich, Gary, and everything. And everyone thinks of Gary because he was the number one overall recruit. But I was talking with Craig about it, and he's like, you know, when we look back at those teams, we're going to think of it as Chase Winovich's teams and not Rashawn Gary's teams. And this is the guy who could almost be in that mold where you have this ultra talented, highly ranked guy in Owen Power, but Nick Blankenberg has really become a guy that I don't know that any of us saw him becoming 2 or 3 years ago, where he was a nice player, he was small, but he played really hard. And now he's really turning into a guy who deserves to be on a top pairing of a top five college team.
And that whole time I thought you were going to say Keaton Pearson, but you're going to look back and remember this as Keaton Pearson's
team. Keaton Pearson's team.
Anyway, Blankenberg.
But isn't that right about Blankenberg?
Yeah, I mean, he's the captain, which is something. And he, when he came in, you already saw a spark, you know, when he was a freshman and the way he's played over the years. A number of people, and I would like to think I'm the first, but other people will probably challenge that, have been discussing Nick Blankenberg's pro future. And, like, he's got the skating ability. He's got offensive ability. His wrist shot is really, really good, which we saw in the exhibition game. And
the last couple of years. I mean, you could see him sitting at the point, taking shots on the power play. And when he would, it wouldn't be like, oh, no, don't pass it to him. But it'd be like, no, that's a good look. We want more of those.
No, I mean, he's definitely a guy that, like, you could really see a team like Tampa signing, you know, as like an undrafted free agent in the spring, is sort of the undervalued guy because he's not very big at a position where hockey men want to be big. But he's got all the tools, and he doesn't get killed in the defensive end. And he also can play forward. He hasn't, but he's a guy, you know, in the Sergei Fedorov, like, that could actually play both positions. Blankenberg was a forward at the junior level for points in his career. And, I mean, that goal against Penn State, you may remember.
Yeah, the end-to-end rush.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, like, it's there. He could do it if you needed him to. So the toolkit is really good, and he's going to get a lot of experience and a lot of exposure in front of pro scouts this year. So
playing next to Owen Power.
That's working in his favor, no question. And, you know, those two guys together are going to be what gets this Michigan team to where they need to be in terms of late game situations. And when you are a really good team and you have really high end defensive players at whatever level you're competing, you need to lean on those guys heavily. And they're going to lean on this pair a ton, that you would think logically, right? You think
I would
about,
hope so. You hope so, right?
You know, I reference the 2008 Rafalski-Lidstrom pair, where you can look up the box scores and see how many minutes they were playing in those playoff games.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, you probably remember this very fondly, but in 2001, the Avalanche basically just had three defensemen. And they made sure that one of them was on the ice at all times.
Yeah. Especially in the playoffs.
They all played 30 minutes between Bork, Foote,
Rob Blake.
And so, like, this pairing, when you are in an NCAA tournament game or a Big Ten tournament game or playing Minnesota, this pair should be out there 31, 32 minutes. Just eat all of the time, because you need them on the power play. You need them on the penalty kill. You need them at even strength. Yep. Like, you should lean on this grouping, because they can do any situation.
I totally agree. Going to the second pairing, this is where we're pretty sure it's going to be the fourth overall pick from last year's draft in Luke Hughes of Quinn and Jack Hughes. And I'm sure their parents, I don't know their names, but they were just as good of athletes, I'm guessing, given what we've seen so far from their children. But Luke Hughes went 4-2, was it the Ducks?
The Devils.
The Devils.
Same spot as Jack.
Right. And that was that moment where they kind of jumped around in their living room as like they were going to be playing their pro career together. And Luke is, in a lot of ways, Quinn, except he's a lot taller.
Yep. He's got a lot of the same skill set. You know, reading the reports, the scouting reports, very similar reports. They do a lot of the same things well. Quinn may be a little more creative, have a little bit higher of a gear in terms of what skill he can flash in certain moments. But Luke Hughes has the height advantage, and someday in the future that may come in handy. I'm not sure how useful it'll be this year simply because he's very skinny, hasn't really filled out the frame at all. So, you know, I don't really think that having that extra height is that big of a deal right now, but certainly for NHL teams it was, because you can sort of project that out. But he's going to be doing a lot of the things that Quinn did in terms of moving up on the play, and that's going to expose the team to chances the other way. And so the big question is who are you pairing with him?
Right. The last thing I want to ask you about Hughes before we go to his partner is he a two-year player? Or does it depend?
Potentially.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's a chance. You know, Quinn took the extra year, and I think in hindsight it was useful in some ways, and some skills he got better at. But, you know, I think it'll depend on physically how ready is he for the NHL. I also think there's a chance he starts the year kind of slow. He had that foot injury in the spring. I mean, he's cleared to play everything like that, but I do think there's a chance that he's kind of like, in the fall, and then kind of just really gets going after the new year.
Blows up in January, yeah. So the guy that you think is going to be with him, Brian talked to me the other day and was arguing for the opposite case, which is we'll get to this guy in a second, but you think that his partner on the second pairing will probably be Keaton Pearson, whose team this would be in a few years that we will look back
on. I was actually presently surprised to see Triscott on the depth chart with Hughes for the preseason game. So maybe that is the pairing, and that's what I would probably like to see. But okay. Keaton Pearson's a guy that the coaching staff really likes. He got to play every game as a freshman, and then got to play every game as a sophomore on the top pair with their, you know, best individual defenseman in Cam York. So you can't doubt that Mel Pearson really likes Keaton Pearson. Keaton Pearson's thing is that he just struggles to move the puck. He's fine off of it, and he's fine fundamentally in his defensive zone. And, you know, the only concern would be if he's playing Luke Hughes is that if Luke Hughes is playing as kind of a rover, which
it's probably just going to happen.
Throwback to the long forgotten sixth position on the ice in the 1920s. But Luke Hughes, if he's playing up the ice, he might want his partner to make the breakout pass to get it up to him up the ice, because he might not back check all the way.
Yeah.
And if he's, you know, as soon as it's turned over and Michigan gains possession of the defensive zone, if he's flying up the ice, whoever is his partner is going to be responsible for getting it up to him, probably making a pass across the blue line into the neutral zone. And that is something we've seen Pearson struggle with in his career. The pace of play at the NCAA level, when he handles the puck and his decision-making and his processing speed isn't really what you want. And he kind of panics sometimes, and it leads to some questionable turnovers when he needs to move the puck. So he's fine in a penalty killing role. And he'd probably do most of what you want him to in terms of that capacity. That would be my biggest concern.
Yeah. He also was, I believe, Michigan's only skater last year, non-goalie, who played any amount of games to not score.
Yeah, he's not out there to shoot.
Maybe we can get him one this year. He'll be a junior, and again, you know, he'll still have 2 years of eligibility after this year, I guess, because of the COVID year. That's going to be an interesting situation as the years go along as to how teams navigate that. When
you know what Keaton Pearson should do to get a goal?
What?
Just watch Philip Hronek tape and just decide that his thing is going to be that he can hit the net from any part of the ice. If you watch the Red Wings games, Philip Hronek is the master of hitting the empty net from like 195 feet away. And Pearson plays in those late game situations when the empty net is there. If that just becomes his thing, where if you let him touch the puck anywhere, he can put it dead on the cage from any spot, he could get a goal.
We should have a lookout for that. That should be one of the things that we should track this year. So then drifting down to the third pairing, Jacob Truscott, like you said, definitely going to be there. He was a freshman last year, and I guess is still a freshman this year. He played on the under-18 team, not as flashy or as dynamic, but pretty strong in the defensive zone. You don't really notice him a ton when he's on the ice, which as for the majority of defensemen is fine, especially at this level and given the other defensemen that Michigan has. So if he can just be a defensive buddy to someone who wants to go create, he's probably as safe a call as there is.
Yeah, I mean, in an ideal world, I would want him playing with Luke Hughes because he can move the puck a little bit more, and his shot is a really heavy shot. It really thumps, down the ice. And so if, you know, that's a weapon that Luke Hughes' skill could unlock if they're in the offensive zone together. So I would be interested in that. I mean, the reason that made me not think that is, again, how much Mel likes Keaton Pearson. Also, Triscott's still an underclassman as opposed to Pearson being a junior. So that was what made me think no, but maybe I am, again, going to be happily surprised.
His partner is most likely going to be Ethan Edwards, who is basically Luke Hughes light, I might say, where he kind of has the same game, but maybe not the same ceiling. He's a freshman. Will be a freshman. Yeah.
He was skating as the seventh defenseman in the exhibition game, but he and Jack Summers will probably flip. Those seven guys will be in the lineup a lot. So, you know, a lot of talent. He was drafted in 2020, spent his D+1 year, elsewhere, then comes to Michigan. And a lot of things to like about his profile, fourth round pick. And, you know, if he's in the lineup and you're playing then with the top pair, Hughes and somebody, and then Edwards and somebody, it gives you at least one puck carrier on all three pairs. And that's what you like.
And then you briefly mentioned Jack Summers. We've seen him for a few years now. He'll be, I believe he'll be a senior this year, but again, junior eligibility because of the same thing. He had a really nice power play goal last year. And what you and I both, I think, slacked each other, like, wait, was that Summers? Or you yelled, was it Beniers over around the top? Get it to Summers, which is the only time that's ever been yelled in last year. He took a really weird penalty against Minnesota at home where I think he got like a 10-minute.
He threw the stick or he
threw the puck. I think it was down the ice.
Yeah.
All the way down the other end of the ice.
He had some injury things, some inconsistent play. He was out of the lineup for a while, but he's an older guy. And I thought what we saw from him at the end of the year was better. And if he can replicate that over a full season, I have no issues with him as a seventh defenseman.
Yeah.
Or on a third pair.
The other guy that will be in that seventh defenseman role, maybe, or be added in as a forward or just wherever Michigan needs him, is a walk-on Jay Karinen, who came in and took Summers' spot last year in January and scored a goal and actually looked all right. He had the one kind of goof on the road in East Lansing that cost Michigan a goal and eventually the game. But, you know, other than that, as a walk-on seventh, eighth, sixth defenseman, I thought we didn't really notice him, and sort of like free safeties in football, that's just pretty much okay.
Yeah, Karinen was fine. I mean, he was the guy you may remember was added to the roster randomly in the middle of the year a couple years
ago. 2 years ago, yeah.
It turns out that was an academic thing, that he had to spend the fall semester at a community college to get necessary grades to transfer in.
So I think he's a local kid.
Yes, but given our expectations, he has already exceeded them.
Yes.
And no concerns with him as the eighth guy on the depth chart.
And the other guys that we have written down are Holtz and Gingell, both there.
We didn't see any of Holtz last year, if I remember correctly. And
I don't think so.
Gingell, we got to see in the past, was not great. And
two games. I'm guessing those two games when everybody went to juniors.
Yeah, that's probably what it was. I mean, Gingell skated in 8 or 10 the year before, and I saw enough to know that he probably should not be in the lineup, but that's fine. He's a 10th guy on the depth chart.
Yep, I agree. That's probably all of the defensemen that Michigan is going to entertain the idea of playing. If they have to bring someone else in, that will be an issue, I think. We can go to goalie, where Michigan... So you and I talked about this at the end of last year. We talked about when Strauss Mann left. We were debating, he's the best Michigan goalie since. And when you look at his numbers, it ended up being, and now it's a different era and there are like pads and styles of change and all those sorts of things, but his numbers were better than all those goalies in the 90s that Michigan had of like Marty Turco and Steve Shields and Blackburn. And I mean, you looked at guys like Montoya and his numbers were, I think, 915 save percentage and GAA that was, I think, around, oh, I'm going to get it wrong now, but it's right in front of me here. Under under two. And I mean, no one had those numbers for Michigan. I mean, you'd have him in a year, but for a career, it's hard to say that he hasn't been the best Michigan goalie in the last 20 years.
And
or
you know who's
30.
You know whose numbers were better than Straussman's last year?
Is it Eric Portillo's?
Eric Portillo's, yeah. I mean, remember we had that dialogue very briefly about Portillo. And part of it just seemed like the team seemed to play better when he was starting, which often is just random. But
sort of the Sean Hunwick factor where you better play defense in front of the really small guy in net.
Yeah, so I have no real issues with Portillo.
No,
he was very talented when he was picked by Buffalo. I mean, as I always like to say, he was 66th, but he was the fifth goalie off the board. And when we talk about goalies, if a goalie goes in the top three rounds, that's akin to a first round talent at another position.
Yeah,
because goalies just don't get picked very high. So there was a lot of talent there. The size is projectable to the NHL level. And
well, he's 6'6". I mean, he can't be any taller, right?
Well, like, he could be. Ben Bishop was 6'8", I think. But
okay.
So, I mean, he's the size of the modern goalie, which is what scouts want.
And he moves well enough.
Moves well, and there was no goals that, to me, obviously he should have saved. There were two weird ones in Columbus that we will never know what happened because VPN Plus never gave us replays and the camera angle was from the rafters. So, you know, we couldn't really tell if that ant was able to save what was going on.
Well, one was the stick handling behind the net, but if you look, I think, at it again, it looks like it takes a weird hop off the board.
It took a weird bounce, which there's a camp of people who just are like, goalie should never touch the puck. And then there's another camp of people who I think are more rational and who sort of say there are uses for it in certain contexts. And this Michigan team in particular, I think, could use it because they have the athletic advantage where you could have Portillo come out and play the puck. And you can leave your forwards a little higher up on the play because they can skate back easier, and that he could make that half ice pass up to catch another team in a change.
Well, he did that a few times last year where he came out to the dots to get pucks, and everyone's like, whoa, where are you going?
Right. And the point is, it has use, right? Like, there's two main uses for that. Number one, it breaks down the opponent's forecheck if your goalie can get out there first and move it to the defenseman before they can get there. And secondly, like that. Sort of the Kent Johnson goal we saw on the exhibition game, right? You can leave your forwards higher on the play up in the neutral zone, and he can come out and make that pass up the ice. I mean, the truth is, it's not very many goalies who are like this, but when you do have a Martin Brodeur, a Marty Turco, Mike Smith, it can be a third defenseman. It's a cliche, but it is true. It can be a third defenseman in terms of moving the puck from the back end forward. And again, he seemed pretty adept at it. It wasn't like he was trying to do something he couldn't do. However, you are going to accept that at one time in the year, maybe two times in the year, it'll burn you. And it's a trade-off, right? So,
No, I agree with that. And I just think that, like you said, there's too much upside there that if you give up a goal or two, I mean, how many goals should this team score, right? Like, they should score a ton of goals, and yeah, you want to pick your spots, and maybe you don't do it in a really high leverage situation, but the sheer volume of cushion that he should be working with over the course of the season, you should be aggressive.
You have to view those kinds of things in the grand scheme and not lose the forest for the trees, right? And this is how Portillo wants to play. And so, you know, you kind of have this dialogue about, so, you know, in game six of the first round this year, Travis Dermott of the Maple Leafs does this bizarre spinorama, which he does a lot, and he turns it over, the Canadians score, they win the game. And so after the game, everyone's like, well, Travis Dermott, never do that spinorama in your defensive zone again. And it's like, well, that's how he plays. And a lot of the time, it doesn't end like that. And it just happened to end like that in the most painful situation. But again, this is how the guy plays. And so it's going to burn you every so often. You hope it's not in an overtime of a playoff game, but maybe it will be. But you have to balance out the gains and the losses that you incur from playing the way you play. And it's actually probably worse to tell a guy to not play the way they play.
Right.
And to get tight, you know, in a high leverage situation.
Yeah. And then do something dumb more often because you're not really sure what you should do.
Yeah.
So Michigan is scheduled to play 36 games, non-exhibitions, How many games do you guess Portillo starts?
28, 30.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. The other guy who will probably get those starts that he does not start is transfer Noah West. And I'm not sure if I know much about him, so I'm going to let you talk about Noah West.
He played at Robert Morris, and then Bobby Moe canceled their... canceled their... yeah, that's a that was an old softball nickname for them, because Michigan played a tournament against them one time.
That's phenomenal.
I think that might have been the Sarah Schaefer perfect game, if I remember correctly.
Oh, okay.
2018. But anyway, they canceled their program, which is very unfortunate. And so all of their players were mercenaries. And Mel Pearson called up Noah West, got him to the program. He was pretty good last year in the Atlantic Hockey Conference, which obviously you're curving for competition. But
yeah.
Second team All Atlantic could be worse things than that. So
well, and Michigan did need a backup, and they probably weren't going to use a scholarship. And I mean, you got to, if something happens, you got to have somebody.
Yeah.
Right. And Jack Levy played the back end of the third period, I think, on Saturday. He's been on the team for a few years now.
The modern day Chad Cat.
Chad Cat. There's a reference for you. Yep. Those are the players that we will talk about that will play this year. I don't think we skipped anyone. Now we can get into a few other things. The first thing is we've teased a few times the power play, so we can talk about special teams. Penalty kill, I think, is more straightforward. We'll touch on that a bit, but the thing that we were looking for on Saturday was how is Michigan going to set up on their power play one?
Well, they're going with the 1-3-1 power play, which is all the rage now.
And they've been doing that really since the CCM days of 2016, when they have the people to do it. You need a defenseman to be able to play up by himself on the blue line.
What's really changed is that because Tampa has done it so well and with such devastating effectiveness that now every team is basically just trying to fit the pieces exactly. Like, you read any discourse about right now Maple Leafs training camp, and it's like, which of the pieces are Kucherov? Which of the pieces are Point? Right? We're plugging them in. Yeah. And so Michigan are going with Beniers at the net front. Mm-hmm. They have Kent Johnson on the left wing.
He's in the middle. Oh. The left is Bortolo, and the right is Brisson.
Sorry. Brisson on the right side, Power at the top. And, you know, the big sort of question, I think, for this unit is being able to move the puck across and change sides, right? Getting that passing laterally left to right, that's something that really throws the defense off if you can do it really well. Having the dual threat of shooting on both sides. And what I'm really looking for especially is creating chances that are not just the Brisson shot.
Yeah.
Because too often they fell into that trap. And, you know, obviously you're going to have – he's a really good shooter, and so you want to get him the puck and stuff. But power plays can become stale when it's just the same thing over and over again. And
you can scout for one shooter, right? Like, you can plan a penalty kill to stop one shooter.
And
having
two shooters or
a second option is different.
That's the kind of thing of what the Tampa power play is really good at, is the fact that, like, okay, you have Steven Stamkos on this side, one of the great shooters of his generation, automatic from that position. But, like, also you have to worry about Kucherov on the other side.
Right.
And their ability to change sides really well, deadly. And then you have Braden Point in the middle, who gets so many chances right on net. And so Michigan figuring out that dynamic will be big. I think they might use Power's slap shot a little bit more than Tampa uses Hedman's, but
He had a couple bombs from the point last year. He had 3 goals in total. Obviously, one was that really nice stick handling goal.
Yeah.
But I think he definitely had one from straightaway last year.
Yeah, just him moving it across. I mean, there was the highlight reel goal they had in the exhibition game where it goes from one side to the top and then across. Yeah. That's what they're going to try to do. But you need to have more moves than that. And then I think the other question with the power play, too, is that, okay, if that's your number one unit, your second unit, I mean, me sketching it out, probably Blankenberg, Hughes,
yep,
Samoskovic, Dylan Duke, Beecher, maybe? That last spot.
When Beecher's healthy, yeah. I mean, you could play him in front of the net.
Well, I think you would put Duke in front of that in that situation. You use Blankenberg as a shooter. given the wrist shot. So I think that this should be about a 90 seconds of PP1 and 30 seconds of PP2 given.
I agree. The Avs have done that for a long time, or the last couple of years, with their vaunted power play of going about a minute and a third or so. So maybe,
I mean, I don't even think the Edmonton Oilers have a second unit.
It's just McDavid and Draisaitl for 2 minutes.
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, it should be a unit that is really good. I mean, it's tough to fit more talent onto the ice than what Michigan's going to be able to do. And you have a bunch of guys that can shoot. You have a bunch of guys that can score from different angles. At times, Michigan struggled to get the puck in the zone. I hope that that's not
that
the case this
be a
year.
Concern.
You should have plenty of guys to make a zone entry. And even on line two, I think you're going to have more talent than most teams are facing against a second power play unit. So
here's what I will say. Power play still requires coaching, though.
Yes.
And that's, you know, something to measure the staff on. Like, you can look at the way that, in theory, having John Tavares, Austin Matthews, Mitch Marner, William Nylander, and Morgan Rielly should produce a deadly power play. But it didn't last year. And that's like one of the big storylines of the preseason, the training camp, is like, how was that not a good power play? And so
what are you guys actually doing?
Yeah. So in theory, it should be great, but it also requires some coaching. So the talent doesn't just do it for itself. It's actually a pretty strategic and schematic part of the game.
And that'll be interesting as the year goes along to look at what kind of unique stuff they try to come up with. And what, like you said, okay, it's fine to get the puck to Brisson on the right dot if he's open, but what else can you do? And can you come up with something that's going to be stuck in the back of other people's heads where you can't completely sell out to try to block that shot?
Yeah.
Special teams the other way in the penalty kill. I mean, this is like we talked about, like the back end, you got Blankenberg and Power that are going to probably be your number one pairing there. Obviously, if one of them's in the box or they've just come off the ice, you're going to go with other guys. But Truscott and Person both have been great.
That would probably be your second grouping.
And the thing is, I was talking to a scout who was telling me about this. He's like, you know, you don't have to change defensemen on the penalty kill very often.
Because
you don't, they're not really chasing and they don't really have to go anywhere. So their legs really shouldn't die right away. The front two guys, the forwards, need to be changing. You probably need what I would say 2 to 3, maybe 4, that you can go to up top. But the defensemen, you probably don't need more than 4 guys rotating through on defense there, unless one of them is in the box.
Yeah, I would agree. And I mean, for the forwards, Van Wyn and Moyle will be one grouping.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's just kind of, do you split up Bortolo and Beniers, because you'd want one of those two guys for face-off purposes. And obviously, Beniers has a lot of defensive skill himself. So then it's just kind of who's the last guy. You
know, I mean, Luke Morgan.
Morgan is an obvious
spot.
One for the speed.
Granowitz is another one. He's a bigger body.
As long as they remember how to put their stick on the ice, obstruct passes, it should be fine.
Which was just the nightmare for November and early December last year, where, what did you say? Just 4 orange barrels standing out in the defensive zone.
Yeah, they were totally unable to obstruct the change of sides, which is the most dangerous pass on the power play. So,
but if that happens, I don't see a lot of issues with this penalty kill. It should be good. You guys, everyone is experienced there. I mean, I'm sure Hughes and Edwards will get their looks at in time, but they have 4 or 5 guys they can go to who've been there a while or decent in their own zone. It just seems like this is not a unit that I'm going to worry about until I have to.
Yeah.
The next thing we can look at is, that's kind of interesting, is the schedule. It's extremely front-loaded this year. You have a lot of games at Yost before January, and even conference games where they host Wisconsin, Notre Dame, and Minnesota, who probably are the next 3 teams that the 3 of the 4 best teams in the Big Ten. So they all come to Yost early, which means that Michigan will be going to all of those places in the second half of the season, which will make the second half of the season very interesting in that regard. But Michigan's going to have a lot of games at Yost and before before the first half ends.
Yeah, and then they also, in their road games, have the icebreaker tournament, which is a pretty big deal,
right,
too. So, you know, it's really up through January 15th, and then after January 15th, you only have a few road games left, whereas you have road trips to Minnesota and Notre Dame in there. So definitely want to bank wins early on in the year.
Which has not been Michigan's forte under Mel. They have struggled out of the gate.
As the year goes on, but they need to be ready from day one.
Right. They start obviously with Lake State this weekend, both games on BTN Plus.
Lake State made the tournament last year for the first time since the 90s, but they lost everybody. So
it might be a Bowling Green situation.
Yeah, Michigan should be favored.
And this is where Michigan needs to come out with a couple slam dunks, because these are games that they're clearly going to be better than. They're a team that they're better than. They're at home. You can't be screwing around giving away a game on some 2-1 garbage or tying teams. I mean, this is what we're at with this team now, is like, you know, we've gone through the years of trying to survive, of trying to scrap things together, of getting lucky in March and all that kind of stuff. This is, if there's ever a team that can dominate college hockey and do one of the old, you know, 33-3 teams, like, that's obviously not the expectation, but the potential is there.
Yeah. And then you look at the icebreaker tournament, where you play Minnesota Duluth, which is a true road game because they're the hosts,
right,
on the shores of Lake Superior. And
if there's a team that every Michigan fan wants to beat.
Yeah, and Duluth, they return a lot of their guys from last year. It's a talented team. Wyatt Kaiser is a really good defenseman they have. But I think Michigan would be favored in that matchup, or at least a toss-up.
I mean, they should be favored in every game they take the ice.
And then you play Providence or Minnesota State after that. Providence didn't, I believe, make the tournament last year, but they return everyone. And given their program track record, should be an easy bet to be a solid tourney team.
Yep.
Minnesota State is a top five team, have the best goalie in college hockey in Dryden McKay. They allow zero goals against, like on average. They just beat UMass, which is a kind of a big deal. That team's really good, and that team would definitely be a measuring stick if Michigan draws them.
And this is a good thing for Michigan.
And they also made the Frozen Four last year. Both of these teams did, Duluth and Minnesota State.
Well, Minnesota State's been sort of the best mid-major, so to speak, for a long time.
I gave them credit because I was always calling them like the overrated team you wanted to get in the tournament because they never win tournament games. But this year, they made the Frozen Four, so shout out to that.
So Michigan will have their work cut out for them in terms of teams that they play. They have a home-and-home series with Western in late October before the Big Ten season starts. They get Niagara over Ohio State football weekend. They do a double hosting then again for the Great Lakes Invitational, which has now become, I guess, two games at Yost and two games at Munn in East Lansing, I think, because Michigan will host Michigan Tech and Western, and then those teams will flip-flop and play at Munn the other time.
Yeah, Tech's a decent WCHA team. I guess that's not the WCHA anymore, is it?
It's the CCHA.
Yeah.
Do you remember CCHA hockey?
Yeah, I do. Not very I wasn't like a big college hockey fan, but yeah. Anyway, you know, Michigan Tech's a decent team. They're always around the bubble, and Western should be roughly the same. So those are games you should win, but they're also not pushovers, and that's what you want. You know, competitive games, but not, you know, the toughest. And then Niagara nestled in there. They were sub-500 in the Atlantic Hockey Conference last year.
Which should
about
speak for itself.
What you need to know. And then UMass lost some pieces off their national title team, but really good program, high baseline. Those will be fun marquee matchups. Michigan, I think, is probably the slightly better team, but again, getting tested in the non-con, which you really like, because I don't think the Big Ten is super deep this year.
So schedule is okay. I prefer fewer games during football season, but I don't make the schedule. So Michigan's gonna have some games that they should win and or could win early, because they will be playing all those teams at home. And they have a couple of Thursday Friday series too, which is also nice. One when they host Wisconsin in late October, and then another one when they go to Penn State. And that's interesting because that Penn State series is Thursday, Friday in Happy Valley, the Saturday that Michigan plays football there. So if you're looking for a lot of Michigan, Penn State, go to State College over Veterans Day weekend.
Yeah, I like that when they do that, where they link the football and the, yeah, and the hockey.
I mean, they should do that with hockey and basketball too, but
yeah,
that would make too much sense for the Big Ten. So in the preseason, is it the media or coaches poll? I'm not even sure. You said this to me, where Minnesota's picked to win the conference, which is fine. Minnesota's going to have a good team. It's not like they don't have any players. But the weird thing was it was basically just the way it finished last year.
Yeah, the national rankings are always like that, where they just like, oh, the team that was the one, they're number one. The team that was the runner-up, they're number two. The team that lost to the eventual winner in the Frozen Four is number three. And the team that lost to the eventual loser is number four. And then they just kind of go backwards from there.
A lot of effort there.
Yeah. So don't put a lot of stock into that. I do think that, you know, Minnesota is worth talking about because certainly if you read college hockey news and you talk to people that are real college hockey folks, not NHL folks, they are very skeptical of Michigan. Because they sort of feel like, well, we're the college hockey people and we actually pay attention to the sport. And what we've noticed is that teams like Boston U often underperform, that they get all the talent and then it doesn't really happen. And so if, like, I was reading the college hockey news' preseason rankings and they were very much like, Michigan's got to prove us that this can work because we've seen enough teams like this not meet their potential.
You've seen enough teams like this?
Not like this, but in this mold, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I was going to say, I don't know if anyone's seen any team like this.
The college hockey establishment is very skeptical, and so it's up to Michigan to prove them wrong, right? And, you know, Minnesota, Michigan's got a better team, but Minnesota, I have full confidence, will be a lot like last year in that Michigan can't mess around.
Mm-hmm.
And if Michigan is losing games they shouldn't, Minnesota will probably be winning games. And mm-hmm. they're going to be consistent. They're a veteran team. It's a lot of the same pieces. They have questions up front in terms of guys to replace and losing Sampo Ranta, Scott Reedy, and one other guy, their top six. But they also bring in a lot of talent. They bring in Chaz Lucius, who was a first-round pick, should have been in the lottery, but slipped just outside of it. Matthew Nyes or Nyes, not really sure how you pronounce his name, but he was a second rounder. They also bring in a couple other guys who were drafted. Like, they have a lot of talent. JLF is back. That blue line, which is basically 100% drafted.
Yeah, or more.
Yeah, Ryan Johnson, first rounder. Brock Faber, second rounder. A lot of talent on that blue line. Really good blue line last year. They're all back. Like, this is a really good team, and it's going to be a consistent team, a well-coached team. They're going to be winning games on a regular basis, and Michigan needs to do the same. And they can't have that period where they mess around again. So that's the good part. It's going to be a competitive chase. It's going to test Michigan. The concern I have with the conference is that outside of that, it's a big drop-off in my mind.
Well, Wisconsin was pretty good last year, and they were sort of in that Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin conversation, and they lost pretty much anyone of note.
Yeah, they still are showing up in not just preseason polls, but rankings by people who I think should know better, and I don't really know what they're looking at because they got rid of all of the guys who were the impact players.
Yeah.
You know, Holloway and Caulfield were just caliber of players you don't replace easily at the collegiate level. And they didn't bring in a really big recruiting class. They don't have a ton of first-round picks who are obviously going to replicate that. Like, it's not like they're the ones bringing in Mackie Samoskevich, for example.
Right.
So I don't really know where their offense is coming from. Like, now they're asking the other Caulfield and a few of their other players who were kind of complimentary pieces, you know, five goal guys, that sort of thing. Like, okay, now you're the top line center. And if you think that's the same as Dylan Holloway, I don't really know what to tell you. Like, maybe guys make big leaps and good on them if they do. I think their defense should be fine. They get Cameron Roback, who was really good as a freshman, and they do add a first rounder on the back end and Corson Coulomans. But I just don't really know where the scoring is coming from, and it's kind of hard for me to see this team anywhere close to the Michigan-Minnesota level.
Yeah, I would agree. The other team that always seems to be in there, regardless of who's playing for them, is Notre Dame.
Yeah.
They always give Michigan trouble, at least at Yost.
Oh, Notre Dame really raided the transfer portal. They got a bunch of transfers, especially in their forwards, and they got a transfer goalie.
From Cornell or something?
From Cornell, which is just the perfect fit in terms of the way they play. And, you know, it'll probably be Notre Dame. I don't really see this as the best version of Notre Dame. They got a big blow when Sasha Pastashov decommitted and went to the OHL. He was a guy that they definitely could have used as a forward, but I think he remembered that he was committed to Notre Dame. And
and they also lost Alex Steves.
Yeah, Alex Steves. So they have some questions offensively. I think they'll probably be around the 500 mark, maybe a little better because the bottom of the conference is pretty weak.
And then we have the three states, right? Penn State, Michigan State, Ohio State. And I don't really know the order of that. Penn State had a weird year last year where they didn't play for a while.
Yeah, and it was not a very good Penn State team. It was a rebuilding Penn State team, which is weird because this year also is rebuilding. I sort of thought that, like, okay, last year was the rebuilding year, and then you bring everyone back and you take that step forward. But they lost, like, three of their top five scorers, and, like I don't know how they had that many veteran pieces to still lose and be the way they were last year. That's kind of strange and not what I was expecting. So it's kind of hard for me to foresee them really jumping into a top tier, given where they were last year and given pieces they're losing and no real, you know, drafted guys coming in. So, you know, that's probably a mid-tier team.
And Michigan State at times looked improved last year, and then at times not really.
I was reading about them on Saturday, and they scored 40 goals in 27 games.
That's not a lot of goals.
40 goals in 27 games.
That is few.
I mean, that's like we have to win 1-0.
Well, they tried that a few times.
Oh, they tried it. It just doesn't really work because you don't win that many games like that. Like, you have to have some guys who can score. You know, you're always going – when you play a really defensive trapping style, you're always going to limit the offense you can create, and it's going to hurt the point output that your guys can score, et cetera, right? Like, Patrick Elias would have scored a ton more points if he didn't play his whole career as
the Devils,
et cetera.
Right.
But you got to have something. Like, you can't – that is just – you can't score – you can't win when you can't score like that. I mean, it's just – you've got to have a pulse. And they lose Combs, who was, like, their only guy who could shoot. They still have Mitchell Lewandowski, but boy, you really start –
he's still there.
You really start to believe that it was Kotarenko and Hirose driving that line because we have not seen much from him.
Well, you're taller than Lewandowski, aren't you?
In terms of being able to shoulder his own line. There was a guy – I don't remember what team this is on, but maybe it was Wisconsin. Someone's bringing in a 5'4 player. it was like 5'4", 165 was this freshman on one of these teams.
I hope that we get to see him play against Owen Power.
Yeah, so it's like when Aaron Judge stands next to what's his face Gardner in the Yankees dugout.
Brett Gardner,
right?
Yeah. Just... that's a good one.
Yeah. Anyway, so
they're at the bottom of the conference.
Yeah, like they're going to be at the bottom until they figure out how to score.
Can they score more than Ohio State?
Well, Ohio State couldn't really score either, but they could score a little bit more than Michigan State. Problem was they. Like, Michigan State couldn't score because they didn't have talent. They also couldn't score because they scored one goal in a game, and then they just parked the bus for the remaining 45 minutes. Ohio State doesn't play like that. They also couldn't really score, and they got, you know, it was just raining goals the other way. I mean, they had a negative, close to negative 50 goal differential in 27 games. And that's the kind of team that takes multiple years to dig your way out of. Like, that's when level of bad. Like, Michigan State, if you dropped just a few respectable guys, they could very quickly be to the tournament level. Ohio State, you need to fix both ends of the ice. You need to fix a lot of things. And they have a few guys I like. I mean, Travis Treloar was pretty good as a freshman, and Tate Singleton isn't a bad player, but they don't really have impact guys. Their defensemen... yeah, they lose a lot of their goalies, and they're bringing in some goalies who are freshmen, and it seems like rebuilding there. And I mean, my big question is, how did this happen?
Yes,
I mean,
that's what I was going to say. What they were in the Frozen Four when Michigan was.
Yeah, they were a consistent tournament team, right at the top of the league for several years, and now it's just kind of like yikes. And it's the same coach, and I don't really know. It's not like the talent dropped off. Like, they lost some guys who outperformed their draft position, like Lisinski.
Yeah, Lisinski was good.
But it's not like they were some loaded team talent wise, and now they're not. Like, well, they don't know what happened. Steve Ruhlich didn't leave. Like, something just went wrong there, and it's probably going to take multiple years to dig your way out of.
They had three or four guys that played really well that would score some goals, and then they just killed you on special teams.
Like, they killed you on special teams, and they had generally good goalie play.
Yeah.
What's his face was really good, and then they replaced him with Tommy Napier, who was really good for a while, and then was bad last year, but also wasn't given any help. And now he's gone. And so it just feels like they're rebuilding from the ground up here, which is something you never want to say 2 years after winning a Big Ten championship. So
that's the conference. It looks like it's probably going to be a two-team race.
Two teams at the top, two teams in the tourney, and then maybe Notre Dame will get another generous bid.
So is anything short of a national title a failure for this team?
Yes, because – well, no. I'm
any other options you want to swing in?
My point is that you should never frame it like that. The Big Ten regular season title is what you want, and then beyond that, maybe the dice rolls your way.
I say with this team, you got to hang some banners. You got to go get the regular season.
Well, and the regular season one is the one that like you can get without relying on some degree of randomness.
Yeah.
So,
but you can, if you win it, then if you win the regular season, you can also ensure that the Big Ten tournament goes through Yost.
Yep.
And then if you can get to be a one seed, which is the team needs to be a one seed, right? Like that's
yeah.
You have there's no excuse unless you get this huge rash of injuries. They have to be a one seed, and then getting the number one overall seed. We talked about this because then you get the Atlantic Hockey champion. And I mean, I know that upsets there happen, but like we also watch what North Dakota did to American last year. So, if you can do that, that puts you in a position to crush a team that you should, and then. You know, you got to win one game, and then you get another banner of a Frozen Four, and I think that's kind of where what you have to really be looking at is this team needs to hang plural banners, and where you get them and how you get them, but you can't kind of have this much talent and come away with no legacy in the rafters.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. I mean, you think you look at the trajectory.
I mean, something even if they don't win national.
When you look at the trajectory of the program, right, you're going to have a lot of talent year after year after year now. And so I think the general expectation should be to win the Big Ten most years. And then hopefully somewhere in the next 5 years, you know, the dice roll your way and you win the national title. Maybe not this year, but variably it should happen sometime. If you continue to put good teams out there and the program is building towards being able to put really good teams out there on a regular basis. And that's what you want.
Yep. I agree with that. Anything else that we missed? Those are all the notes that I had.
Nope. They play Lake State on Friday.
I think
final...
it's 7:30 on Friday and 7 on Saturday.
Something like that. The Saturday game is going to get trampled by the football game. But
yeah, I mean, that's – yeah. We'll have notes on that. I'm not writing for that game. I will write something up for the Friday game. And then we will try to see as much of the Saturday game as we can and then do a hockey cast next week so that we can have some things to talk about.
Well, luckily, because of the way college hockey works, the game will be over by like halftime of the football game because the football game takes 4.5 hours. You know? And
regardless,
and hockey is 2 hours long at the college level. So
especially when it's on BTN Plus.
Yeah. That'll move right along. So. You know, the remaining season preview posts should be up on the site either within the next few days or will already have been up by the time you listen. So look an eye out for that. And then we will meet back next week and get ready for the icebreaker.
And we congratulate you if you made it all the way through this, what seems to be about an hour and a half podcast.
Yeah. For listening to Michigan Hockey Cast 4.1 for Alex Drain and David Nasternak. Come back next week where we will break some ice.